Tomorrow, many of us are celebrating Thanksgiving with our families, but it can also be a time to come together across different faiths.
When we begin those one-on-one dialogues, we realize that the distances between us are not as great as we are led to imagine.
Rabbi Alan Cook and Imam Usman Sawadogo join us to share what they're thankful for. And with lots of generations gathered under one roof, how can you help those who aren't as tech savvy?
Last year, Creed asked me how to set up a blog, wanting to protect the world from being exposed to Creed's brain. I opened up a Word document on his computer and put an address at the top.
But first, with Black Friday fast approaching and Christmas around the corner, it's the time of year when people shop a lot. But how's retail actually doing in many places? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Happy Thanksgiving. Coming up this hour, I sat down earlier this week with two Central Illinois faith leaders. I had a chance to talk to them about the interfaith Thanksgiving service they attended and organized. And I'll hear about that as well as what they're thankful for. Also, we know that lots of folks are gathered a couple generations under one roof this week. Maybe you're asked to be tech support for your family. We have assembled our favorite U of I engineers to help you out on that front and give anyone who needs some tech advice before the holidays. You can give us a call for that. That's going to be later in the hour, of course. On Friday, it's Black Friday, and with that fast approaching and Christmas around the corner, it's also the time of year when people are shopping a lot. And what originally began as one crazy day of shopping has expanded to a week-long sales and deals. Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined generate billions of dollars in spending. How's retail doing actually overall, though, and here in Illinois, especially when we're thinking about big box stores like Toys R Us and Sears filing for bankruptcy? Are brick and mortar stores doomed when we're thinking about online retail giants like Amazon? Joining me now to talk about this from Springfield is NPR Illinois reporter Mary Hansen. Also on the line, we have Rob Carr, who's president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Mary, Rob, both of you, welcome back to the 21st and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Rob, we have Thanksgiving before Black Friday, but we know lots of stores are going to even be open tomorrow in anticipation of Black Friday, which has become such a big deal. How much do retailers plan around this one day in their sales year?
I don't think it's really become a one-day event anymore. I think it's transitioned into a longer selling season. Black Friday's origination became because that was the kind of the day of the year when retailers moved into the black. Prior to that, they were spending their year operating in the red. The season, given the spreading out of the retail sector into more areas, more outlets, including online, it has become a little different, but they focus pretty heavily on it. It's the quote-unquote kickoff of the holiday shopping season. We know that a great many of the consumers really start their shopping a little bit before that, but really start looking hard at the deals that are offered beginning on Thanksgiving and Black Friday. And it carries through to Small Business Saturday and then, as you mentioned, Cyber Monday. So it's really become a kickoff of 4 days, essentially.
And when we're thinking about, particularly I'm thinking about our traditional retail merchants across the state, whether they're small businesses or big box retailers, how important is the holiday shopping season for, is it the most important holiday season in terms of making or breaking a business for the year?
I think undoubtedly it is the most important. It is the point at which consumers are the most engaged. They are all of consumers are really looking to make purchases above and beyond their ordinary course of living. So it is very important in every channel, every size. It's vital that they do well. And thankfully, at least, the projections are that this holiday season should see between a 4.3% and 4.8% increase over last year. So that's a good projection if consumer confidence holds.
And I was going to just ask you about that in terms of that projection, because we did see, I saw Target's earnings were yesterday, I believe, right? And weaker than expected Target stocks. I mean, the whole stock market hasn't been doing great this week, obviously, but certainly we saw some big retail stocks having a hard time yesterday. Target's, I think their earnings were a little disappointed in terms the market was a little disappointed by those earnings. I mean, when we're thinking about traditional retailers, how tough is it right now? We're thinking about this holiday season. Every year we think about Amazon and how much more it grows. How much more tough is it this year than it was in years past?
It's very tough, but I think there's several things at play, and this probably doesn't fit very neatly into a segment, but there's so much to talk about. But retail has always been the most dynamic of the business sectors, and it is the most competitive. That has only become amplified with technology really becoming a seamless part of everyone's life. The number of transactions that occur on just smartphones continues to grow at a rapid pace. I think the stat was that in 2012, they did something like 7.8 billion in transactions. That number has grown and expected to close out somewhere between 93 and 94 billion this year. So in 6 short years, it has grown exponentially. So retailers, whether you're a brick and mortar or online, really have to stay on their toes. They have to not only anticipate where the consumer is going and be ahead of them. They have to be extraordinarily competitive. And unfortunately, that also means, and we operate in very narrow profit margins in addition to being the most competitive. So that means that any actions that governments take, for example, whether it's state, local, federal, that enters into those margins, retail theft becomes an issue that takes away margins. It all works together to either create a successful year for retail or to create an unsuccessful one.
That's Rep Carr, who's president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Mary Hansen's also with us from NPR Illinois in Springfield, and she's been reporting on this issue, including, I'll get to Mary, I want to ask you about the story you did most recently about sales tax. But first, I just wanted to ask you, when we're thinking about Illinois as a whole, do we have a sense of shopping patterns? Are people shopping at the mall, big box stores, online? And I imagine it might be different if it's rural versus urban. What are we seeing, Mary?
Yeah, I mean, Rob might be able to speak to this as well, but I mean, I know the kind of national trends are more this holiday season. They're kind of expecting pretty much even for online sales versus in department stores, and then also pretty strong interest in discount stores as well. We are seeing fewer people going to malls. We're seeing malls kind of increase their vacancy rate and seeing a lot of stores there closed because kind of the changing shopping habits. Kind of people want that convenience. They want to either shop online and have it delivered to them, or stop into the store and pick something up. Fewer people kind of interested in walking around and around the mall. Those are some of the trends that we're seeing.
And when we're thinking about online shopping and we're thinking about Cyber Monday coming up this year, Mary, there's been a change to what sales taxes are collected by some online retailers. Can you tell us what Illinois shoppers should be prepared for when they're buying things online this season?
Yeah, so we'll probably see more online retailers collecting sales tax after the June Supreme Court decision in the Wayfair versus South Dakota case, where they allowed the Supreme Court said it was okay for the state to collect sales tax from retailers who are not based in their own state. So traditionally, it's been if you have a presence, an employee, or a store or a warehouse in a state, then that state can require you to collect sales tax. So now retailers outside of states are allowed to, states are allowed to collect retail taxes from retailers outside of their own state, as long as they have sort of a big economic interest there. So if they make more than $100,000 worth of sales, or if they make more than 200 transactions. So Illinois, in their budget in the spring, put in a provision requiring these bigger out-of-state retailers to collect sales tax. So you're likely to see more online retailers collecting that tax this holiday shopping season.
Right. So that people should be prepared to be paying those sales taxes maybe in a different way than they have in years past. And Mary, when we're thinking about brick and mortar stores, there's always been a lot of seasonal hiring. What are you seeing in terms of retailers preparing for holidays when it comes to seasonal hiring?
Yeah, so as Rob mentioned, retailers are expecting a really strong year this year in terms of holiday shopping, and they're preparing by hiring more seasonal workers. And given the kind of tight labor market, we're seeing these retailers hiring both in their stores and their warehouses, having to either offer a little bit higher wages or advancement opportunities or more benefits like discounts at their own stores to attract these additional workers. They're also started hiring seasonal workers earlier in the year. So looking at hiring folks, they were starting to hire folks at the end of the summer and the beginning of fall to kind of help prepare for the holiday shopping season.
And Rob, you're with your members for the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. I imagine, is all of that hiring pretty much done, or has it been such a tight labor market that there are still needs that need to be filled across the state for seasonal work?
I think most of the hiring needs to be done, but there are always still needs, particularly in this tight labor market. And so retail is always in a position of hiring. So if someone's looking, they should not be discouraged from going and applying now. I think there's many opportunities for those who are willing to work.
And when we're thinking about that, the flip side of this is, I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, Rob, stores like Toys R Us and Sears filing for bankruptcy. I wonder how other stores, what you're seeing with your Retail Merchants Association, how they're adapting to avoid that, this kind of fade.
Avoid bankruptcy?
Mm-hmm.
They have to, as I mentioned earlier, retail is always an evolution. So we always become alarmed when we see, you know, trademarks that perhaps we grew up with fading away or changing. But that has been the story of retail forever. It appears to be happening a little more quickly these days, but technology has quickened our lives in many aspects. I think there's other functions at play as well, you know, that we can get into perhaps at a later date. But all retail is looking at how to make it a seamless experience for consumers. We used to think about it just as different channels, just online, just brick and mortar, and then within the brick and mortar, just certain categories. That's no longer the thinking. The best retailers are now integrating both online and brick and mortar. And I think if you think about it as a continuum, that's really the wrong way to think about it anymore. I think that continuum is now bent to become almost full circle. You see brick and mortar getting heavily into online and integrating that into all of their operations. You also see online getting into brick and mortar and integrating that. So I think we're going to continue to see increased partnerships, whether it's strategic partnerships or direct investments by the various players, so that it's really a seamless operation for the consumer, and that they have the ultimate in choice. Many, for example, want to purchase online, but they don't want it delivered to their home, so they deliver it to a brick-and-mortar location. So, for example, 7-Eleven and Kohl's are just two examples of entities that have partnered with Amazon to have drop-off boxes or lockers where you can then order and go pick up in those locations. That provides opportunities to bring consumers into those stores as well, where they're, I think, noticing in their early experiments that consumers are also making purchases in those brick and mortar. So that's just one example of the ways that they can integrate and meet the needs of consumers.
Rob, I wanted to ask you about Target also being in the news in Chicago for its closing of stores on Chicago's South Side. And there's been some, there's been a rallying point for some protesters in the neighborhood. And I'm thinking particularly of Congressman Bobby Rush, who's called for a Black Friday boycott of Target. And in a letter to Target CEO Brian Cornell, he wrote, "Your closure of these stores is a classic example of persistent disinvestment on the South Side of Chicago, because the Target stores, two of them, meet both retail and grocery needs that are vital to the neighborhood residents who he represents. By closing them, your corporation is leaving a gaping hole of retail service as these communities have few options." Despite the protests, we should point out that Target has said they have no plans to reverse course from the closure plans that were announced a few weeks ago. Rob, when we're thinking about particularly the South Side of Chicago, which we've seen Whole Foods go into a neighborhood in Inglewood, when we're thinking about urban areas, what are the challenges for retailers? I wonder how similar they are to when we're thinking about challenges retailers maybe have in small rural areas as well.
There are a lot of reasons for all of this. I think first you have to start with the viability of areas. You have to have a concentration of disposable income depending upon the type of retailer that is operating there. While you mentioned Whole Foods has gone in, that has not been without criticism. There have been criticisms that they don't offer the same goods, that it's still too expensive for the area. It's a moving situation for every retailer, and smaller retailers may make it where larger retailers may not. I can't speak specifically to Target, other than Target has said repeatedly that those stores in question have been hemorrhaging money for many, many years. The days of retailers operating at stores at a loss are gone. We never thought we'd see CVS, for example, or Walgreens close pharmacies. We have seen that. We've seen them close hundreds of them because they're no longer willing to or able to subsidize losing stores. Stores have got to stand on their own. And I think also, at some extent, government has to look in the mirror. Chicago is not without its significant challenges. They need to look at themselves and see what they're doing and the atmosphere they're creating that make it harder, particularly for industries with tight margins like retail, to operate in throughout the city of Chicago and all of the neighborhoods that it encompasses. There's not a simple answer to any of this.
Mary, we've been talking a lot about big business, but just as we wrap up here, we've got less than a minute. I just want to ask about small businesses. What's a good way for our listeners to think about our smallest businesses or independent businesses throughout the state and support them this holiday season?
Yeah, so sandwiched between Black Friday and Cyber Monday is often a small business Saturday. I know there's a lot of shop local organizations and chambers of commerce that promote or do events on that Saturday to kind of bring folks out to support their local retailers. So that is one good way of supporting local businesses.
Thanks for that. Mary Hansen is a reporter with NPR Illinois. We'll tweet out Mary's most recent story, by the way, about taxes, so you're familiar with what you'll be paying when you're shopping online. I want to thank Rob Carr as well, president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Mary, Rob, thanks for taking the time to speak with me this day before Thanksgiving. Have a great holiday.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you. You as well.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting the Art and Design Faculty Exhibition on view November 1st through December 8th. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tomorrow, many of us will be celebrating Thanksgiving. What that looks like varies a lot from household to household. For many of us, Thanksgiving, the best of it, is a time to come together with friends and family. It's also a time for people to come together across different faiths. This past weekend, the Interfaith Alliance of CU hosted their annual Thanksgiving celebration at the Krannert Center for Performing Arts. Amidst the music and celebration was a message of unity and diversity. Joining me now in our Urbana studios are two people who took part in that. Rabbi Alan Cook is from Sinai Temple in Champaign. Imam Osman Sawadogo is with the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center in Urbana. Rabbi Allen, Imam Sawadogo, both of you, welcome back to the 21st and happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rabbi Allen, I wanted to ask you about, you started this interfaith service, it was 2 years ago, and 2016 was the first one of these. How would you say things have changed? And I wonder what your goal was when you first started 2 years ago with what you wanted this to look like.
Certainly. So the Alliance itself, the Interfaith Alliance itself in its current incarnation has been around since 2014. And so by 2016, we had grown to a point where we really wanted to take some of the relationship building that we've been able to do amongst the different faith communities and really express it to the community and show the community how important it was and how possible it was for people to come together in the spirit of fellowship. It so happened that the first event took place right after the presidential election, and so there was a certain nerve that was struck of needing to push back a little bit about some of the stuff that we were seeing in the community, where many people, even on the national stage, were encouraging us to be fearful of those who were different from us, and that we instead wanted to send a message of embrace and of realizing commonalities. We've been able to continue to build upon that, even in the face of some very difficult moments in our nation. And this year, again, unfortunately, we find that it's striking a nerve with some of the tragic shootings, Tree of Life congregation in Pittsburgh, in the synagogue, but also just that general sense within our society that people are so fractured. We know around our Thanksgiving table, we may be encountering people with different backgrounds, with different opinions, with different beliefs. And to be able to say in our community that here is a wonderful population of people who love one another, embrace one another, can see beyond differences and celebrate the basic humanity in one another.
And so, Rabbi Cook, you had a couple, so it wasn't just Jewish and Muslim folks that were there yesterday, and as part of the Interfaith Alliance, which I should mention, you were stepping down as chair at the end of this year. Can you give us a sense of the different groups that are involved?
We have been very successful at drawing in the Western faith, the Abrahamic faith. So we have various denominations of Christianity, a number of different Protestant churches throughout the community. We have Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center and Muslim participants. We have participants from Sinai Temple and from the broader CU Jewish community, Hillel Center, and so forth.
And the Roman Catholic community as well.
The Roman Catholic community, of course. And I don't know if I mentioned the Baha'i community. And so those are the Abrahamic faiths. And we're beginning to be more successful in our outreach to some of the Eastern traditions as well.
Imam, I wonder how much people see these services, but you all meet regularly. You all are seeing, you all are in developing relationships with each other, and that's been going on for years. What does that look like? How often are you all meeting with each other?
We often meet once a month, every Wednesday from 11:30 to 1, sometime 1:30. So it has been very good for me, and I believe for the community too, because I can see the difference now today or in yesterday's service. Comparing what happened yesterday with when I first came and I first brought the idea of interfaith. And the mosque before me were engaged in interfaith activities, but I think that the community was not as open as they are today.
Your people, community?
Yes.
Okay.
People are very comfortable in going to different places of worship, participating in different gatherings. So I think that that's an achievement and a good result of the Interfaith Alliance.
Red, I was at the service, and I did notice there were quite a few people from your congregation who were there, which I do think it seemed bigger numbers than had been in years past. Do you think that for people within your congregation, is it a question of making sure that they know that they will be welcome and feel comfortable in a place that's not maybe a space that they're not used to being in?
I think that they see the similarities between the teachings of Islam and the teachings of other Abrahamic faith. So they feel more comfortable going in this gathering. They don't expect to encounter strange teachings to the teachings of Islam. And one of the most important things that I realize is that the Interfaith Alliance is always trying to focus on commonalities and similarities, and this makes people welcome. And I think that this helps people too.
Rabbi Cook, I wonder how much when you're doing not just these services, but the interfaith work, when I think the dominant message is so much in our culture right now about division and difference, how do you focus on similarities? How hard is it to do that?
I think when you break it down to its essence, it's not that difficult. We encourage people to enter into a one-on-one conversation with people that they don't necessarily know so well, hopefully from a tradition maybe that they're not so familiar with. Usually the questions, you know, how does your faith tradition encourage you to celebrate Thanksgiving? How does your faith tradition inspire you to wake up in the morning and so forth? When we begin those one-on-one dialogues, we realize that the distances between us are not as great as we are led to imagine.
And unfortunately, we have these horrific events that people have gathered around in the past couple of years as we've talked about different hate crimes. And I'm thinking in particular of, it's been a couple months, Rabbi, since you and I have spoken. And I think people, since that time, there was the horrific murder. 11 people were murdered at Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue. And I wanted to just ask you about, first, how your community here in Central Illinois has been processing and coping with the worst anti-Semitic attack we've ever seen in American history.
It was just a heart-wrenching event to deal with, I mean, not only for the Pittsburgh Jewish community, but for the broader Jewish community. And we think of ourselves all as one family, and when, you know, one person is harmed, certainly it reverberates throughout the country and throughout the world. But, you know, more broadly, there was the wonderful recognition from people of faith throughout the CU community that that we were hurting, and the tremendous embrace that we received for arrangements and cards and calls and emails and messages of support, and children from Wesley United Methodist Church made us beautiful multicolored prayer flags, and so many wonderful outpourings. So the tragic event, of course, took place on the last Saturday in October. And so by Sunday night, there was a community vigil on campus that was so lovingly attended not only by members of the Jewish community, but by so many friends from Simic and from other faith communities who just recognized the deepness of the pain within our community and knew that, you know, if they stand up for us and for the Jewish community, that we will in turn stand up for them. We pray that it's not necessary in other times of tragedy, but the fact that we can come together in times of tragedy and in times of joy and love is just a fabulous thing. And then the first Sabbath following the shooting, we opened up the doors of our congregation. We were blessed to have, again, people from many faith groups. But, you know, I say this not just because Imam Usman is sitting next to me, but because of the wonderful feelings of friendship that they showed. But a large number of individuals from Simic came, attended our Sabbath worship, and immediately after our Sabbath worship, then we were able to provide a space for them to have their evening prayers. And not only was it a wonderful thing from an emotional standpoint to have that wonderful support from the Simic community, but what a powerful object lesson for them to come and worship with us and participate in a faith tradition that was not their own, and then for my congregants to be able to witness them then engaging in their own prayer tradition. It makes it all worthwhile. You know, I would never ask for such a tragedy like that to be repeated, but to know that we have friends, brothers, cousins, sisters, whatever, however you want to refer to that relationship, is just incredibly heartwarming and pushes back against the divisiveness that we're seeing in our community.
Imam, I wonder if you can share a little bit why it was so important for you to do that and to have that service. And I'm thinking in particular of in the past, when the both of you have been together, we've talked about how the temple and the Jewish community has shown support for the Muslim community. And I'm thinking particularly about, you were talking about after the travel ban, all the cards and flowers and things that you all got. We've seen Muslim communities raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for Jewish communities in America since the Tree of Life shooting. But why was it important for you to have your congregation with the Sinai Temple after the Tree of Life incident?
Yeah, it was important because when we were in difficult situation, Sinai Temple and the interfaith community in general stood up with us. And this is what I said at our after our service on Friday when I received the email from Rabbi Allen. And the service was Friday night, and the time was not, we did not have enough time. But I say that I will let people know that we have really been blessed to have Sinai Temple and the NTFF community standing with us when we were in difficulties. And this time, we also need to stand with them. That's one part. Another part is also we identify the same concern that they will have, they're having now, because we have been also in this situation in the past. So people felt that they were they have to stand with the Jewish community. And after the service, when I mentioned that, I expected to have only a few people, two or three. So I said, just give me your name if you're coming. And what I realized that people were coming to me with name, write my name, write down
you,
my name.
You had quite a few. How many people did you have come?
More than
Simic?
10. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I even don't know, don't have the right number, but names were coming. And at one point, I said, just, I will not take name anymore. Let's meet at the Sinai temple. And like you say, we don't want this tragedy to repeat, but I think that it shows us something, that we are together and we need to stand with one another and make sure that we support everyone who needs support in the community.
That said, I wanted to end by asking both of you what you're thankful for this Thanksgiving.
I'm thankful to live in a community that that this is possible, that we don't simply fall into our convenient categorizations, or silos is the popular term for it, where we put on our blinders and we only interact with people that are like us. But I'm thankful that I can have a genuine friendship with the imam and with members of his community and with members of the broader faith community, and that we can strive to build bridges of understanding. There's that quote that comes post Holocaust from Pastor Martin Niemöller, about first I came for the Jews and I didn't stand up because I was not a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not stand up because I was a trade unionist. And the recognition that we have that one of the reasons why we need to have each other's backs in a society like this is that we can't just sit back and let them, kind of pick us off one by one and then move on to the next minority group or the next oppressed group. But by recognizing that there are commonalities and unfortunately common enemies, and banding together, that we can show that we're stronger. We can say not in our town, and we can defend against the enmity and the hate.
Yeah, I'm also thankful for being blessed with a community that accepts, embrace diversity, and a community also that pay attention to concern and sensitivities. And like Rabbi Allen mentioned before, every time we go to Sinai Temple during the services, we are blessed to have a space for our prayer. And this is one of, I think that this is one of the important things that attract more people to interfaith. Because you know that if you go to a temple, Sinai Temple, you go to a church, and the prayer time comes for Muslim, we pray five times. We not have to leave the temple to go and find another place. We know that we will have a space for prayer. And so I'm really blessed for that.
Well, both of you, thank you for taking the time to come in and speak with us. That's Imam Osman Sawadogo from Simic, the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, and Rabbi Alan Cook with Sinai Temple of Champaign. Both of you, thank you for being with me. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Coming up after the break, with lots of generations gathered under one roof for the holidays, how can you help those who aren't as tech savvy? We've got some tips from some tech experts, and they can help with your questions too. Wonder how often you need to update your phone? Do you need tips on battery life? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Send your tweets to 21STShow, and we'll get to that right on the other side of this break. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The holiday season is upon us, and that means new technology for everyone, but it also means having to figure out that technology. Whether that's setting up Wi-Fi on a new smart device or teaching Alexa to play the radio, lots of family members, and when you have a get-together, it inevitably turns to, hey, could you mind taking a look at my printer? Our own 21st family has our own tech experts, and we've assembled them here to help you. Mike Bowman is the Assistant Dean of Technology with the University of Illinois College of Media. He's also our Chief Digital Officer at Illinois Public Media, our home station. Irene Sakalarakis is a Senior IT Specialist at the U of I's College of Engineering. Mike, Irene, thanks for being here. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving. Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
If you are listening and you have a question for Mike and Irene, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. If you're the person your family and friends turn to when their phone breaks or their tablet won't update, we would love to hear from you, too. Again, that number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your stories as well to 21STShow. Mike, I bet every year, or tomorrow is Thanksgiving, I wonder around the dinner table, do you get the same questions from your family about tech every year?
They vary every year, but the one that always sticks with me is one of my uncles. It seems like every year he asks me what kind of computer he should buy. And I'm starting to wonder, like, does he not buy a computer each year and he's still got the same one? I don't think he's buying a new one each year. But he asks me every year, should I get a laptop? Should I get a desktop? What brand he should get? Should I just go to Best Buy and buy one? It's kind of funny that, and it could be this has just kind of been a memory that's kind of cemented itself in my mind that didn't actually happen exactly that way, but that's the way I remember it.
Are there some common things people get wrong when they're getting a new device, whether it's a laptop or a phone or a tablet, and they are setting it up for the first time?
I think the thing that I see people do is usually happens more on the purchase side, is that they sometimes buy like a laptop, like, oh, I want a laptop. And so they go and buy the laptop that they think is going to be the best for them based on what they see at the store, that they might spend $400 on a laptop. And that laptop is not going to do what they want to do. Within 6 months, they're usually frustrated with it because it's going to be slow and just annoying because of all the extra software they put onto it. And so at least that's what I see when I work with people that, you know, want to get buy their own machine, that they sometimes will go to like Best Buy and just, you know, buy whatever is on special or whatever. And then they end up being frustrated with it because it doesn't do what they wanted it to do.
Right. And when we think about Black Friday deals, I think people sometimes look at doorbusters and they get really excited. Are there things you guys buy on Black Friday or that you look out for technologically wise as a good deal to pick up?
For me, I don't actually buy a lot of technology personally, but for especially people at work who will come and ask me what they should get so that they can kind of go between home and work, I will dissuade them from getting whatever happens to be the blue light special at the moment.
Oh, okay. Why is that?
Well, again, kind of echoing what Mike said, it often, if you don't know what you want and you get what you think you're being told is the accurate thing for yourself,
it might not be.
It often isn't. I mean, the biggest issue for me, the biggest thing that I tell people is you need to know what you want it to do. You can't just go and buy a Dell. There are many Dells out there. Oops, can I say that on the radio?
You can say brand names on public radio. That's okay. You just can't say prices. That's
okay,
our rule.
Fair enough. So it's not just about going and buying the brand name or whatever you've seen because it has a glitzy ad. It's about understanding what you need and the kinds of work that you want to do or play that you want to do, and then fitting your requirements to the device itself. So you kind of have to get a little bit educated about basic things like how big of a hard drive, whether you want a mechanical or non-mechanical SSD, how much memory you want in there.
And I think those are the things that are really confusing for people. And I wonder how you can translate that into sort of, I guess, English, I would say, because I think it does feel like speaking another language when it comes to technology. So, Irene, I wonder how you go about describing that to someone who doesn't understand the lingo.
I try, again, to have a broader conversation with people about their needs and then try to match what I know about the components to what they can do or not do for the people who are asking for it. So, for example, if someone says they want a basic laptop that they want to have at home occasionally to check email and so that their kids can do their homework or play, you know, sort of a basic video game, I will show them how what we call consumer models at work, the kind of cheaper lines, the lines that you'll see in a Best Buy or Circuit City, how those could fit kind of the basic functionality that they might be looking for, but that it doesn't take very much to tip the balance. So if they think that all they really want to do is email at home, and then suddenly they want to start working with Adobe Creative Cloud or something like that, then very, very quickly the 4 or 6 gigs that they'll get in those commercial machines will go out the window. I mean, that'll just suck it all up pretty quick. So I do spend a fair amount of time with people talking about how to think about the purchase that they're going to make rather than just saying, oh, yeah, here's a cookie cutter model. Go get that one.
That's Irene Sakalarakis. She's a senior IT specialist at University of Illinois College of Engineering. And Mike Bowman's also with us. He is the chief digital officer at Illinois Public Media. He's also the assistant dean of technology for U of I's College of Media. And we are here to answer your questions. Or if you're the person your family and friends turn to when their phone breaks or their tablet won't update, you can share your stories as well. Give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions or your stories to 21ST Show. Oh, here's a Twitter question we just got. My parents always want to know if they should or shouldn't do a certain update. They live in fear of updates. My parents feel this way. I live in fear of updates. My parents ask this, and I'm always avoiding the iPhone update. I think, Mike, you and I have talked. I don't know if I've talked to you about this. I try to avoid it for especially the first couple of days after they pushed it out because I feel like there's going to be problems. I don't want to install something that's going to be buggy. I'll wait a couple of days until they figure it out. Yeah. But when we're thinking, let's start with phone updates. Mm-hmm. How important are those?
Phone updates are pretty important because you're going to get a little bit of feature improvements almost always with those, and they'll fix some bugs that may not affect you yet, but sometimes they do. You might get a little bit of interface improvements. And so on the app side of things, what I do with my phone is that I have it set up in my iPad too to automatically update when new app updates come out and just install them and take care of them. Every once in a while, there's a new iOS update for the phone itself, is I have a few apps that are kind of I'm also a pilot as a hobby. And for some of those apps, they say, don't put the newest version of iOS on your device until we tell you it's okay. Because every once in a while, like you said, there's something that, you know, doesn't quite work right. And so typically I'll wait at least a few days or, you know, sometimes even weeks if I haven't heard from one of those places. But I think, you know, with your phone, you know, waiting a few days, maybe a week or two is okay. But you definitely want to do those if it keeps, you know, asking you to do them, because the longer you don't do them, the longer you open yourself up to possible hacking, to glitches that could cause problems for you, all that kind of thing.
So updates are important. I think a lot of people don't want to update their phone because people complain about their battery life after a new update. Maybe their phone is kind of old and people are worried. This is, particularly when we're talking about Apple, I feel like this is Apple's way of pushing you into buying a new phone. I wonder what advice you have for people, but you think the updates are important.
I think
still.
So. I mean, if you've got if you have an iPhone that's, you know, maybe a couple years old and you haven't updated yet to the newer device, then it might be worthwhile to wait because Apple is certainly...
If you have anything less than a 6.
Yeah,
because,
if you had...
Right?
Yeah, because I think it was last year, Apple actually admitted that they, in some of their software updates, they put in to make things a little bit slower because they're expecting and to do things with the battery life a little bit differently. because they know the hardware doesn't have that long of a lifetime. And so they thought they were trying to do it to help people. But I think kind of underneath that, the asterisk to that is like they're also hoping you're going to buy a new phone.
Okay. 1-800-222-9455. If you have tech questions or if you want to share stories of being the tech person for your family this holiday season, let's go to Sharon from Findlay. Hey, Sharon, happy Thanksgiving. What's your question?
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too. I was just curious if you guys have any idea on a way to boost my internet in a rural area.
Your Wi-Fi isn't good. Is that it? Or do you use
correct?
And do you use hotspots on your phone, or how? What do you do?
We have Wi-Fi that comes into our home from an internet provider, but I also, in order to watch Netflix or you know any type of streaming, it constantly buffers. I can use my phone as a hotspot too, but the only thing with that too is we are at least 4 miles from a tower, for my phone too. So sometimes we do also buffer with that.
Thanks for sharing that, Sharon. I've heard this from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Mike, Irene, any advice?
I would say we're both making a face like, because it is really hard. There are certainly been improvements, but it's still not, if you're in a community where you can get DSL or, fiber or other, cable internet, those are all going to be faster than, what you're going to get especially if you're out on a farm, specifically. There's a few different providers that are around, and I'm not familiar with anyone in particular that's better than others. But I think, if there's, there are sometimes position makes a difference. And so, for example, if you wanted to go with a mobile hotspot, kind of solution, I know a few different carriers have a mobile hotspot kind of a option for you. And, if there's a way to put that, near I wouldn't put it like outside on the roof. But if you had, say, an upper floor somewhere in your house to put it that's closer to the direction that the cellular tower might be, you might get a little bit of improvement in that way. And so position can kind of help in that way. But it's really a challenge because rural areas still are really underserved when it comes to broadband internet speeds that, mm-hmm. Just kind of we assume are everywhere.
Yeah, so much of it has to do with the ISP and how much juice you're actually getting into your house to begin with.
And which is really tough in a lot of rural areas.
Right.
We've talked about
that. And then that gets attenuated through Wi-Fi as well. So if you have a larger home, then a repeater might help within the building itself, within your house itself, if you have a couple floors. But it's a tough call,
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you guys about security. In particular, a lot of people are concerned about this now, whether it's Facebook or email. There's lots of ways that people's information can be compromised. Mike, what advice do you have about protecting yourself? Let's start with email.
Sure. With email, what I always tell people is that if it seems even the slightest bit suspicious, don't click on any of the links in the email or open the attachments. That's how you get malware or ransom, or even worse, ransomware. And you really want to try to avoid those things. And so if you get an email that says it's from the IRS or it's from your bank or something like that, it's probably not. But you can always just, if it's from your bank, instead of clicking on a link in that email, type in your bank's website into your web browser, because then you'll know you didn't click on a malicious link. And theoretically, somewhere on their site, they should have information for you that was the same if it actually was from your bank.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll actually call people. You get spoofed email addresses, particularly working on campus where it looks like a legitimate email from a legitimate person who even has their Skype for Business light lit up. So it looks like a real person.
Yeah, because they're getting very sophisticated.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I am that person. It's like, did you mean to send that to me or not? So you just confirm with the human.
Someone in real life. Mm-hmm. Two-factor authentication is something that the University of Illinois recently implemented for lots of different sites. So there's lots of people in the Champaign-Urbana area who are using this now. But this is something we're going to start. We are seeing already as another security measure, right, Irene?
Correct. It's something that's been around for quite some time. Many banks have already had that implemented. I know I was playing with cryptocurrency and I couldn't log into anything without 2FA. Mm-hmm. And it's a second measure. It's still not 100% foolproof, but it's one more
It's basically another layer of security.
It's another layer of
security. Anything that's like a two-factor authentication just requires you to log in twice.
Twice, right, by two different means. So on campus, we have tokens that we can use, but there's also online authenticators. Campus uses Duo, but Google has a Google Authenticator as well. And it's it'll send you a little token, a little number, and you either type it in or you tap.
Right. So when your bank asks you to send, so when someone texts you a code and you have to punch a code in to your phone, that's what that is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mike, do you recommend that people install this in as many places as possible?
Yeah, most definitely, at least as far as it's convenient, because certainly some of them are not very convenient. But I've been using Google for Gmail, using Google Authenticator for years now. And the nice thing is that if somebody were to somehow get my password, it's useless without that second factor.
We are out of time, but thank you so much, you guys. Next time, we'll have to have you here longer. Mike Bowman and Irene Sakalarakis, both of them with U of I, Irene with the College of Engineering, Mike with the College of Media. Thanks, you guys. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we are taking the day off to celebrate Thanksgiving. We hope all of you have a wonderful holiday. Next week, as Giving Tuesday approaches, join us. We're going to talk about ways to give responsibly to your favorite charities. In the meantime, please enjoy the time with your family and friends. I am very thankful to everyone at the 21st who works hard on this show every day. Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great Thanksgiving. See you back here on Monday.